Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we're back here with another episode as we roll into our summer months here, and lots of great things and great topics coming up for you in the coming weeks. So make sure you stay tuned and spread the word about the Disaster Podcast and everything you can find over at disasterpodcast.com. And as always, I'm joined by my expert co-host, Sam Bradley. Sam, how are you?
I'm great. I'm counting down the days. My team has been on call this month, and knock on wood, we'll still be here over the next few days. And it seems like we're looking pretty good on the hurricane front and so forth. But summer is one of those times when the hurricane door is open, and Joe's got tornadoes rumbling through his area, and there's a lot of things going on.
Speaking to Joe, Joe Holly joining us from Paragon Medical Education Group. Joe, welcome back.
Thanks, guys. Great to be here again.
And I know there's been a lot of storms rumbling through the Midwest and coming by the South and hitting all sorts of areas. It's really been quite an active season as far as thunderstorms, severe weather in that respect, tornadoes coming through.
Absolutely. It's been quite busy. We've been lucky enough here to dodge anything really severe, but as usual, it's all up and down Tornado Alley. And I guess we just had a big event sort of in the Northern Plains just into last week with a couple of fatalities there, I believe.
Yeah, and we're recording this at the end of June, so if you're thinking back to the news items and you're listening to the episode, you know, we always record a week or so in advance, and so that's what we're talking about. And I was thinking of the twin tornadoes were a week or so ago when they had some really stunning pictures of a tornado that spawned two separate tornadoes. That was pretty spectacular photography, but it must have been terrifying for those on the ground.
Absolutely.
And we have to, if some of you listen to this podcast where Jamie talked about his first experience with a tornado, that was quite an interesting story. And that's the thing. I mean, we're all kind of used to whatever's local where we live, but we don't have a lot of exposure to the other types of natural disasters out there, except those of us that do it for a living, of course.
Well, and, you know, talking about the weather, and we've just a couple weeks ago, it's become summertime, lots of things come up when summertime hits, and it made me think a little bit, Joe, about how weather affects disaster response. You know, obviously in the summertime, you add that heat aspect to an already problematic event when you have a disaster response, because food doesn't keep as well in the summer months. It's going to go bad faster. People need more fluids when it's hot out. So having good drinkable water available for everybody is a challenge. There's lots of things that come into play depending on the weather and the season you're involved with.
Well, there's no question about that. You know, certainly it's much more challenging when you have extremes of weather. And unfortunately, Mother Nature isn't too prone to put a disaster right on a, you know, nice 65-degree sunny spring day and keep it that way for you. So those challenges all have to be factored into not only the ability of the responders to respond and take care of themselves, but also the impact on the victims of the disaster themselves.
And ironically, the summer is when is the most popular season for being outside and having county fairs and big. I live fairly close to a hill. There's a big venue that does these high-end concerts where there's thousands of people, and I mean, those kinds of things go on all summer. It's nice in the evening, but especially, like you said, Jamie, during the day when it's hot, people don't really think about hydrating like they should. Plus, you add alcohol on top of that. That makes it even worse. And, oh, my God, that's a whole subject in and of itself we should cover one of these days, just heat.
Well, yeah, definitely. And we can also springboard into our topic for today, because you brought up major events, festivals and fairs. And I know in around this area, in the Mid-Atlantic area, several big multi-day music festivals going on, where you have large numbers of young people, lots of alcohol, lots of drugs, and very hot and humid weather, which sometimes can lead to some major issues. And we kind of talked about it last week, and I thought it would be a good topic for this week, is talking a little bit, Joe, with you and Sam, about the differences between major event medicine, as in, you know, a planned event when you know you're going to have 50,000 people and in a small location for a prolonged period of time with a certain, at least in some ways, foreseeable set of circumstances. Compare that type of response where an area can be overwhelmed easily to what happens in a disaster.
It's kind of like event medicine is when it goes well, and MCI medicine is when it doesn't. What do you think, Joe?
that's a good summary, Sam. You're right. You know, I mean, they definitely have some commonalities in that there's a lot of people, and in many cases, the resources are overwhelmed. But, you know, I think the plus to event medicine is the ability to sort of pre-plan for those. You can certainly incorporate all the factors that we were talking about, whether that's the amount of intoxicants or the weather or the event, et cetera, and be able to predict with surprising regularity the numbers and types of injuries and problems you're likely to have, and be able to pre-stage resources to take care of that, as well as just being able to plan for the system's ability to continue its daily function while you take care of this large surge of additional people or problems or whatever, as opposed to a disaster where you're that's thrust upon you with whatever planning you may have done in the past, but you have to sort of pull all that off the shelf and put it into motion on very short notice. So some similarities there, but also an awful lot of difference in how you can respond to those things.
Well, and it's funny you mention that, because you're taking me back to when I was in Southern California, I worked for one of these large venues just for fun with one of these event services agencies, who their total function in life is to go out to these big venues and provide, you know, whatever level of medical support that they provide. But what I would notice is just from one week to the other, the difference. It's in the type of people that would be out there. I mean, you got your country folks. They like drinking their beer, but they're basically pretty good, you know, as far as, well, there's a few fights and so forth. But as opposed to a bunch of young people, as opposed to, okay, we got an older, I don't want to throw out any names, Tony Bennett or somebody, that the older people like. Now we're worried about CPAs and MIs. I mean, each different entertainer or group of entertainers brings in a very different audience. And so the types of injuries and illnesses that we see is also very different. So that alone is intriguing. And like you said, the pre-planning for those events is going to be very different.
Well, no doubt about that. And I think, you also have in some ways the ability to sort of narrow your scope just a little bit. You certainly have much less to worry about from acute cardiovascular illness in a young crowd, except as it's related to heat illness or intoxication or something along those lines. So you can sort of narrow your scope of concerns there a little bit. Obviously, in a disaster, you're just as likely to see a cardiac arrest as you are a major trauma or an exacerbation of some chronic ongoing medical condition that's been made worse by the destruction of the infrastructure.
And you have to be prepared for any and all of it.
Exactly right.
You know, I got to interview a guy that owns an event EMS company out in Las Vegas that covers events in and around that area when I was out at the Consumer Electronics Show, which is an event that brings several hundred thousand people and journalists to Las Vegas into their convention center there, and they end up having around 125,000 people in the convention center at one time. And he is one of several ambulance companies that provide on-the-ground foot patrol general medical services They also have a golf cart. They also have several ambulances on scene. And that's along with the several nurses that are stationed that work for the convention center itself that are there for medical emergencies. And it was just fascinating to talk to him about how they prepare, even for an event like that. You'd think a convention, you know, what could possibly go wrong? But
you never asked that, Jamie.
You know, it's a group of businessmen, you know, but it's multiple cardiac events, multiple people, you know, becoming dehydrated and having situations go on, plus bumps and bruises and scrapes and everything in between. And he basically said it was the preparing for the event that you had to plan for this and make sure you had enough coverage for X number of people. And it's over the years, these large events have kind of developed a way to estimate what they think they're going to run into based on previous events. And you know, that's a luxury you have with event medicine that you don't have with a disaster response. You don't have that ability to have units and things on the ground as the event occurs.
You know that you're going to be needed for a particular venue, but on the disaster side, we just have resources kind of staged for the what if. We just don't know what that what if is going to be. So there is some similarities in having resources. It's just this, at the event medicine, they know exactly how many people they're going to have, what kind of an audience they're going to have, what kind of weather or alcohol issues they're going to have. And it's fascinating. I would love to get this guy on the podcast. I'm sure he could tell us some great stories about things that went well and things that didn't go so well.
Well, I agree with that completely, Sam. You know, I think the other issue with disaster medicine is that you often have no control over the venue. So, mm-hmm. You know, while you may know this is going to be in an outdoor stadium or whatever, in the event of a disaster, you have no idea where that's going to be. And obviously that makes for challenges on many levels, not only the pre-planning piece of that, but just understanding the lay of the land, the issues associated with the area that you're in. If it's a pre-planned venue, then you tend to at least have some concept of where you are and what the infrastructure looks like around there and where the power is and where the food is and all that other sort of stuff. But in a disaster, you may have none of that information.
And like Jamie alluded to earlier, there is a time gap. I mean, we look at 72 hours at least before federal resources are in there. But even at the local level, somebody has to go in and make an assessment and make a determination of how big the area is, what kind of injuries they have, are there any deaths involved, to determine, just to begin to determine, what kind of resources are actually needed and how far out you have to reach to get them.
Yeah, well, it makes me wonder, Joe, you know, if you know, is there a way, you know, is there a difference in the way you educate and train people for event response versus a disaster response? Or do you still learn the same similar skills for assessment and things like that?
Well, I think there's certainly some commonalities there. The patient care aspect is not that much different. I think it has a lot to do with what your capabilities are and maybe how you deal with that patient. You know, in an event situation, that kind of setting, the infrastructure is generally intact. So the trauma center is working and you got, you know, ambulance transportation if you need it. You have resources in place and you sort of know what those are. In the disaster situation, the assessment of the patient may not be that much different, but what you do with that assessment, it becomes very different because you may not have a hospital within 100 miles and no way to get the patient there anyway, and are in essence, you know, sort of on your own. Not only from the patient care standpoint, but the where am I going to take this patient? What am I going to do with them? Even if they're not terribly injured, you know, if you've got heat to worry about and, you know, flooding and all sorts of other issues, you may not be able to leave the patient there, but where are you going to take them? and where they, what's going to happen when they get there? Is there any kind of resources at the spot that you're going to be able to take care of the patient from there? So I think the thought process has become much longer range and much not only do you have to have a plan B and C and D, but probably a plan, you know, G, H, and I to make certain that you're ready for whatever the situation may throw at you.
And what you're saying too, Joe, is you're looking in an event medical situation, you're looking at more of an acute situation, be it medical or trauma. You have discussed on a number of the podcasts some of the long-range effects of someone who may be trapped for a period of time or, you know, dehydrated or not nourished properly. And these are very different than the kinds of things we would see in the more acute setting where those are not issues. So I think that's a big difference right there. And the type of care, not only the type of care we can render, but how is that person going to change and become worse over periods of days? Because at least we know that this acute patient is somebody we can get somewhere else to be taken care of before that becomes an issue.
Well, you're exactly right. And we have talked about that some before. You know, I think that's the one element about disaster medicine that is really unique to disaster medicine. And that is that compounding and confusing factor of time that is just generally not something that we deal with on a day-to-day basis because we don't have to. We have 911 and the emergency department and all that sort of stuff. And patients, when they have something bad happen to them, tend to call for help pretty quickly until they can't. And those are pretty rare situations and almost always occur in disaster situations. So that's about the only time you get to see some of those fairly unique disease processes and some much more common disease processes that have been affected by long time frames that are not what we typically see in our day-to-day practices.
You know, and another element is security and acts of violence. I mean, when you're dealing with heat and young people and alcohol and all of that, but at least in an event setting, they're kind of prepared for that. They will have security people that are not that far away that can deal with these things. But in a disaster situation, it's very different. Your resources may be very light in terms of what you have available. You never know when and where there's going to be an issue. We have to worry about the security of our own medical command, our tents, and you guys out there digging people up out from under buildings. You know, that's a huge element right there that makes event medicine different than disaster medicine.
Well, I agree with that completely. You know, the issues of security and sort of taking care of your own in those situations is always challenging because you're right. All of that infrastructure is gone. And not only do you have to worry about the ability of your team to get the job done, but do I have enough supplies, equipment, and resources to take care of my own people? And what if one of my people gets hurt? And, you know, certainly from our the medical standpoint of a lot of the USAR teams, we spend a lot of time preparing and looking into what our resources are for not only the patients that we may come across, but our own people. And that includes our dogs. So, yeah. You know, in an area where a disaster's occurred, we may well be busy trying to figure out where the closest veterinary hospital is and all sorts of stuff along those lines to ensure that should something happen to one of our folks, we can get them the care that they need fairly quickly.
Joe, when you go into a situation with your team or Sam, when you guys go in with the DMAT team, do you have a local liaison person that gets assigned to your unit to help you find, you know, whether it might be a good place to set up your resource or what available infrastructure is still functioning to connect you with things that you might need while you're deployed?
Well, ideally, yes. Unfortunately, the situation is often that there's nobody available, or if they are available, they're certainly helpful as far as a guide is concerned and being able to sort of, you know, navigate you around the area. But they may have absolutely no information at all about whether or not a hospital two counties over is functional or not. So that's one of those episodes where Google is often your friend. We do a lot of work by Google for sure. And, you know, in many cases, we will actually go there and look and actually see what it looks like. I've certainly gone to many hospitals in disaster areas that we're told through emergency operations centers are opening, and you drive up there and they are indeed open, and the only person there is a security guard sitting inside the front door saying, sorry, there's nobody here but me, but the door's open, but there's nobody here. So that hospital is in essence non-functional and of no value to anybody. So it's challenging to get accurate information about what. It's another one of those definition things. Well, it's open, but it's not functioning. So those are two very different words and two very different definitions that are very important to be clear about.
It brings us back to that conversation we had last week on, the communication aspect of really making sure you understand what is being told to you and very clear in your use of terminology, because having a door unlocked and being open are two different things.
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's exactly true, and I think it's also that kind of healthy dose of skepticism and sort of realizing you can't always trust everything you're told, not because people are trying to mislead you, but just because they simply don't know. And I think the psychology of that is often, they want to help you, and they want to tell you, and they want to show you what they know, and they want to be helpful. And so they'll tell you what they think as opposed to what they know. And sorting those two things out is quite important to really know what your resources actually are.
And there's obviously a lot of misinformation, as we see always early in a disaster. The numbers change daily and everything changes. But in the aspect of going into a disaster area, it's very different for the DMATs because, again, we have more time. We're not the primary resource going in, where the USARs are there more immediately and they have to kind of make some of those decisions. But for us, it's always someone has always preceded us to look, do what Joe was just talking about, look at the area, see what the resources are, see where we best fit the need. Is it creating a mobile field hospital outside of a hospital that may be somewhat functional, but it's damaged to the extent that they can't take people into the building itself? Or are we functioning as a surge capacity resource where perhaps there's just so many people coming into the hospital that we might set ourselves up as a triage clinic so that the people we're sending into the ER actually need to be in the ER? Or are we out in an area where there is no resources, there's no electricity, there's no water, there's no nothing, which we have the capability of doing for 72 hours. We can plunk down our tent and we have our full disaster resources, both for the people coming in and for the people living there. We have our quarters to live in. We have all of that. So all of that does have to be determined and pre-planned, and especially in terms of where are the DMATs going to do the most good. So that's a huge effort that's done by the folks that precede us in this effort.
And that all comes back to being prepared. You know, we compare event medicine and disaster medicine, it seems to me that while one is prepared because they've done this before in the sense of having a given event before, part of what helps disaster medicine be prepared is having that expertise of people who've been there and done that before. And Joe, you know, you guys at Paragon bring a lot of those types of been there, done that type of training to the table.
Well, you're right, Jamie, and again, it is very much sort of been there, done that, and I think those things are hard to learn and hard to appreciate until you've gotten out there and had a chance to see it and see the impact of it. You don't realize what things are important and sort of where the small details really grow in importance over time. And learning to appreciate that early on really makes a difference.
Well, one thing I'll throw in here, too, though, is you can go on 25 different disasters, and they're all going to be different. You're not going to run into exactly the same scenarios, even if they're all tornadoes or they're all hurricanes. You're not going to run into the exact set of circumstances that you had the first time. But having that experience and having that training, which, honestly, we might have a major team-level disaster once every 5 years. What do we do in the meantime? If we don't practice putting those tents up, if we don't practice our patient care reporting system, all of those things. But what it does give us is our ability to think on our feet. So we have enough experience behind us that we may have learned from this one and learned from this one and learned from this one, that we go out on that one and we're going to say, okay, well, this is different, but here's what we can do about it. Because we're pulling on all of those resources that we've, you know, and all of the people that have been on different events, that we can pull those together and say, okay, this is how we're going to manage this.
It seems like you're talking about that having that previous experience builds a certain level of self-confidence that you can manage even though there's going to be differences. Joe, and what would your thoughts be on that?
Oh, I think you're dead on target. You know, there's so many things going on in a disaster, and it's so overwhelming in so many ways, that just having a little bit of prior experience with it gets you through those distractions at the beginning and allows you to at least begin to focus on the important stuff. And as we've said several times before, I think that it's not that folks can't figure out how to do it. It's just that those disaster events are oftentimes a once in a career problem. And by the time you've been through one disaster and sort of learned those lessons, you never get a chance to apply them again because there's not another disaster that comes along. So if you can learn many of those lessons in training, then that first and probably only disaster you're going to be in is the one where you'll already have the lessons learned.
But here's the truth. We love the challenge. And I know that Joe can't tell me any different, that when we go out there and we're faced with something new and different and pretty scary, we love the challenge of being able to figure out how to best utilize the resources we have to make this thing work. That's the people we are, is throw us in the worst situation and we're going to figure out how to make it happen.
No, I think there's no question about that, Sam. You're right. That is part of the challenge and part of what we enjoy about it. Is a chance to sort of test ourselves. But I can certainly tell you, early in my career, those things were pretty scary. And, looking back on that, you really realize, wow, I didn't know how much I didn't know when I first started doing this.
Well, and that takes us back to training. And the fact, again, like I said, we might get one of those major deployments every 5-6 years, whatever it is. So what do you do in the meantime? You have to provide training that is relevant. You have to provide training, a lot of hands-on, so people remember how to put those tents up and they remember how to dig somebody out from under a brick building. And if you don't do that, then they're not going to be ready when we get there. And some of the people go, oh, God, we got to do more training. Well, you do. And if you're not interested in doing that, then maybe you shouldn't be on the team because you're not going to deploy that often. But you really need to have your head in the game when you do, for your safety, for everybody else's safety, and for certainly those people that we are serving out there.
But isn't that reaction to training somewhat an indictment of the type of training they've had in the past, and why something like what Joe and Jim are doing at Paragon makes them so valuable? Because you guys don't just do the typical death by PowerPoint training. You know, you're doing something that's experiential, that's relying on people with real expertise, and is going to give people that hands-on aspect that's going to make that training much more valuable and much more interesting.
Well, that's certainly what we hope, Jamie. You know, we're big believers in the kind of stress inoculation concept of you got to really do it like it really is in order to really appreciate the subtleties, the things you don't think much about, the mistakes, et cetera, so that when the stuff really does hit the fan, you're prepared for that, and it's just another day at the office.
And let's face it, we're a bunch of A personalities, and there's only so much we're going to get out of sitting in front of a computer and listening to the theory behind something or other. It really isn't going to become real until you get your hands on it and you play with it and you make mistakes. Like we said earlier, you want to make your mistakes in training, so you're not going to make them. And those are the things you're going to remember when you get out there in the real world on a disaster. Oh, I remember what this happened. I'm not going to do that again.
Exactly right.
Joe, where can folks find Paragon if they want to find out a little bit more about what kind of training you guys do and maybe how they can bring you guys into their area to do some training with their agency or a group of agencies and organizations?
Well, you can certainly find us through the Disaster Podcast website, but we also have our own website at ParagonMedicalGroup.com and on Facebook under the same name, Paragon Medical Group. And our Twitter feed is ParagonMedEDU.
And so, folks, get out there and friend, follow, or whatever with Paragon, and ask them some questions. You know, pick their brains and find out the tremendous resource that they are and why they're just so valuable. And Joe, we really appreciate Sam and I that you and Jim and the rest of the team in there at Paragon put your backing behind the Disaster Podcast and help us bring this show out each week. We really appreciate your support, and we can't say enough about you. So, you know, folks, if you like the Disaster Podcast, you know, take a moment and visit Paragon's website, talk to them on Twitter or Facebook, and just say thank you for bringing the Disaster Podcast out. It's important to do that, and find them as a valuable resource. You really should have them locked in as a resource for your agency and community.
I would totally agree on that. And I have to say, too, this subject we're talking about tonight, again, the time went so fast. We could certainly go back into this idea. I mean, there's just so many thoughts and ideas and different kinds of events and disasters that we could pull out of this conversation. I hope we can revisit this later.
Well, I think we can do that, Sam. And, you know, that's the beauty of a show like what we do, is that there'll be opportunities to revisit a lot of topics in future, because these things are perennial topics that we have to deal with. And it's important to re-talk about them and have different guests on to discuss them. And so we're going to reach out and do that. And we urge you, if you know of somebody that would be a good resource to have on the show for an episode or two or three or whatever, you know, go to disasterpodcast.com, leave us a comment in one of the articles over there, send us their contact information, or reach out to us and let us know that you'd like us to have somebody in particular on the show or cover a particular topic. This is as much your podcast and community as it is ours, and we want to make sure that you have an opportunity to be an active part of that community. So get out there and let us know what you want to find out more about with regards to disaster response and disaster medicine. Sam, where can folks find you?
You can find me on the usual social media places, Sam Bradley 11 on Twitter, Sam Bradley on Facebook, Sam Bradley just about anywhere, and most certainly on the disasterpodcast.com website.
And you can find me under the handle PodMedic most places out there. So look me up on all of the social media sites. And, of course, you can find me over at disasterpodcast.com as well. So until next time, I'm Jamie Davis, the PodMedic, with Sam Bradley and Joe Holly here at the Disaster Podcast. And we'd just like to thank all of you for checking out the episode and look forward to having you back for future episodes here in the coming weeks. Sam, why don't you close us out?
Well, as always, disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.